Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. We bow to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. The teaching I have to give you is, I hope, completely within the system of thought that was spelled out by the Buddha. Since coming to California last year, I'm aware that there are many, many spiritual traditions that you are exposed to and that you have the opportunity to enjoy and take advantage of. Probably what's might be a little different about people in our path is that instead of cultivating a big field with a lot of flowers, we've taken one small, specific, defined system, not that small, and we're trying to go deep. We hope to make the effort to go all the way, or go as far as we can, with the promises that are set forth, the release from suffering, and the kind of true happiness that results from practicing these beautiful mind-healing teachings given to us by the Buddha. The theme of this weekend for me, tomorrow and the day after, I would be giving some teachings in Santa Barbara focused on metta, which is universal loving friendliness. Metta is very integral. It's not something that was just added on as an afterthought to the teachings of Buddhism, but it's something that is absolutely core and essential. It's essential at the beginning, and it's also very important, essential throughout this practice. Typically, if the Buddha met somebody who didn't know anything about anything, just an ordinary person, who hadn't really thought too deeply about spiritual matters, or gone too deep into philosophy, he would often give a kind of a version of a gradual training for this person that would start with faith, with encountering a teacher, or encountering somebody who gives that sense of inspiration, and becoming willing to open the heart, willing to listen, willing to try something out. I can well remember when I first encountered Buddhism in the form of Bhante Gunaratna. I was a recovering alcoholic. I'd been through, you know, all the different messes that people can get into, one thing after another. And I was in that part of the recovery program where they tell you to undertake prayer and meditation. So I began shopping around, looking for what is this prayer and meditation going to do for me. I had a very suspicious and skeptical mind. I was very quick to notice people who seemed to have their hand out for money. I was very quick to notice any kind of small hypocrisy between what somebody was preaching and what they were, how they were behaving. I was very quick to notice what struck me at the time as being superstitious or cultish or too much rites and rituals. I went to one place and they said, "Oh, if you don't have to do all this work, if you just meet the guru and if she touches you, then that'll take care of it right there." And so I couldn't accept any of these things. I was too skeptical-minded for that. And then I happened to get a tip that there was this type of meditation that didn't have any mantras or any special rituals, that was just focusing on breath, that had that purity. And I was introduced to a Buddhist monk, a Buddhist bhikkhu, who was so purely kind, so purely generous, and so purely selfless in the way of giving the teachings that I immediately found inspiration. And that bhikkhu introduced me to Bhante Gunaratna, and again I felt that same inspiration. So that's the beginning of this path, is acquiring some kind of a faith, a provisional willingness to try out a kind of a discipline, a spiritual path. And then the Buddha would suggest looking after one's virtue. I like to tell people, if you want to meditate, okay, here's how to meditate. First, stop stealing, stop killing, stop your sexual misbehavior, become beautiful, thoughtful, and considerate in your speech, become respectful of the dignity of the people in your life, become a person who is always taking care and thinking, is my action or is my speech going to be beneficial to me, beneficial to this other person, to the other person in my life? Will it be beneficial to both? And who has the time to give that thought to avoid through carelessness, causing bad feelings and injury and all kinds of havoc to the people around us? Having done that, a person would acquire a certain kind of a profound happiness and a sense of security, which is the first gift of this path. It's the gift of, as they put it in the traditional teaching, if you can do this and do the practice of metta, then you could feel safe that if you die tonight, you won't go to hell. Or for a modern person who perhaps is not yet convinced about rebirth, you might say that you're not going to wake up in the morning in your own private psychological hell realm because you won't be flooded with remorse about the mistakes that you made yesterday if you can develop those beautiful, virtuous qualities. And so with that initial kind of ease and happiness, then the Buddha advises learning to practice the four Brahma Viharas, which is universal loving kindness, universal compassion, universal appreciative joy, and universal equanimity, to be able to extend this lovely intention, to develop this intention within until it comes to a state of being boundless, that the mind is in a big mind. And then you can, in a form of contemplation, a form of meditation, project this intention for the welfare and happiness of beings all around in the 10 directions without any restrictions whatsoever. The talk I'll be giving up in Santa Barbara is going to go into more depth about developing this specific technique for developing this boundless metta meditation. I don't know about you, but for me, it wasn't exactly such an easy or natural thing, because life is complicated. Our relationships are complicated. When we think of people who are dear to us, it might be that, well, they may not be like 100% dear, they could be 90% dear, and then there's something else that's irritating there. So there's actually some particular techniques and methods to use to actually develop this loving-kindness meditation and make it effective. I'm just going to give you a little preview today. I'm not enough time in 1 hour to make you skillful practitioners of metta. The metaphor that is frequently given, especially in this teaching to lay people, is a metaphor of a conch blower. I guess a conch is a shell, and it's blown like a trumpet. If you imagine that somebody would stand on the summit of one mountain and blow that horn, and the sound would echo across the valley and would go everywhere. It reminds me of, since I hiked, you see, I have these images to call on in my practice. There's a particular bird called the rose-breasted grosbeak, which sounds like a robin who went to the Juilliard School and learned how to sing opera. It's a very beautiful, big, super deluxe bird song. And one time I was in a little valley in Tennessee or someplace, and there must have been hundreds and hundreds of these rose-breasted grosbeaks all throughout the valley, and they were all singing. And those songs were just ringing and ringing and ringing across the hillside. And that's, so that kind of beauty is what we aim for in the practice of metta meditation. As I was taught metta by Bhante-ji, it usually started with some kind of a verbal set of phrases. It was usually done at the beginning of a meditation sit. So it would be something like, may I be well, happy, and peaceful. May no harm come to me. May no difficulties come to me. May no problems come to me. May I always meet with success. May I have patience, courage, understanding, and wisdom to meet and overcome the inevitable problems, failures, and difficulties in life. May my teachers be well, happy, and peaceful. And then so on with all this verbiage for the teachers and for my parents, for my loved ones, for neutral people, and for difficult people. Now, this practice actually was profoundly effective for me. This was the second reward that I got from the practice of meditation, was it healed my personal relationship with my mother. I already told you I was an alcoholic, so I had tried making amends for my years of rudeness to my family, and was disappointed to see that they didn't really seem to trust me very much, or my mom didn't seem to actually believe me when I apologized. But I began do this metta practice, and on a daily basis every morning consistently, to say, may my mother be well, happy, and peaceful. May no harm come to her. May no difficulties come to her. May no problems come to her. May she always meet with success. It took like 3 or 4 days at the outside when I started to feel, well, if I want her to be happy, I should pick up the telephone and say hello. It was not possible to maintain a callous, to say those words over and over again, and to keep a callous attitude. So I called and I let my mom know that I was praying for her. And she's a very devout religious person, and she knows what prayer's about. And it was a major, major turning point in that relationship. Metta is powerful in that way. However, the amount of juice that it's possible to get from the metta practice is even much more than that, much more than making for wholesome relationships and making the lifestyle of what I call beautiful ethics. And that is that the metta practice can lead into deep meditation. It can be the way that it's possible to settle the mind, to obtain the entrance into what in our system is called jhana, or concentration practice, where the mind becomes very quiet, very peaceful, and very focused, settled, free from any kind of restlessness or the distraction that comes up from our hindrances. And that is really the place where the work is done in Buddhism. For people who perhaps have done a mindfulness practice for a long time, perhaps for a number of years, you've been doing mindfulness practice, you've learned how to focus on your breath a little bit, you've learned how to notice your hindrances, you might know when you're feeling sleepy, you know when you're feeling engaged with desires of the senses, or the mind being preoccupied with some kind of aversion or dislike related to the senses, or the mind just being so restless that you want to jump out of your skin, that it's really, really difficult even to hold the seat for the 20-minute or the half-hour session? Are the mind being flooded with some kind of doubt or uncertainty? Maybe feeling that you don't have what it takes to be a good meditator? Or maybe feeling that, oh, maybe this isn't the right practice, maybe you should get one of these catalogs that's got 700 other kinds of spiritual practices and find a different one that will work better for you. I have seen in my life a lot of meditators who get a certain amount of benefit from Buddhist meditation, and they go a certain distance and then they stop. They don't go the whole distance. And so that a person, maybe they've meditated for a number of years and they know how to watch their hindrances how to see the hindrances, how to be not like blaming themselves about their hindrances, but sort of relax with the fact that, you know, they're a human being and you have these formations. But they haven't learned how to give up the hindrances, how to let them go, how to put them aside, how to set them down, so that for a period of meditation, you can have this extremely pleasant and blissful time, that those things are not a factor. And the mind is just able to be there, be with its object, be truly at rest, be truly still, truly away from those kind of disturbances. That's a very empowering kind of practice that creates then the possibility to investigate, like, what's the nature of my existence? What's the nature of my reality? And to overcome basically self-centered thinking, which is the big one that that keeps us all trapped in the cycles that we're trapped into. Now, the metta practice is a gateway to get there. The way that I've learned recently in the past 4 years to practice with metta, instead of doing the metta first and then the mindfulness practice second, it's reversed. First, mindfulness practice. As I suggested before, I gave you a hint to start with your breath and to look at the feelings in the body and just try to notice the feeling in the body, particularly breathing. Where's breathing happening? It's happening mostly like inside your body. And if you are watching your breath, that will tend to focus your attention inside. It's called a proprioception. That's the perception of the position of your body in space. Like, I know now I'm sitting up, I'm not lying down. That's because of proprioception. I can be, if I'm looking inside, I might be able to notice, like, what's the pace of my heartbeat? How does my stomach feel? How does my belly feel? Are the muscles in my body tense or are they relaxed? If there's pain, you know, where's the pain? So in practicing metta, the method is first develop some kind of a stable state of awareness of feeling, especially inside the body. Then bring in a very simple, not that elaborate thing, bring in a very simple phrase of metta. Try just taking four people. Take yourself as person number one. Choose one dear person. A real, actual person, not just a generality, but an actual person who's dear to you. A person who is neutral, that if they disappeared from your life tomorrow, it wouldn't actually be a problem. And then a person who's difficult. But this course of training, you can come to a monastery and spend a year on this. First, you've got to take yourself, and you've got to give a very easy, simple phrase, may I be well, may I be happy. Something that short and that simple. Pronounce that phrase silently to yourself very clearly, so you know that you're actually pronouncing these words, may I be well, may I be happy. And as you repeat that phrase, that's your verbal formation, you want to become aware of the meaning. So it's not just an empty mantra. You're using the phrase to point the mind in the direction and to set up an intention. So you're setting up a volitional formation. You set up a volitional formation, an intention for your happiness. And you might have spent a little time in advance reflecting, what would that be? What would my true happiness be? Is a new car my true happiness? Is right relationships my true happiness? In the end, the kind of happiness that is the most lasting is probably some kind of a spiritual concept of what true happiness is, feeling safe with our karma and feeling some kind of confidence about, will we be okay if we die tomorrow? And having done that, what we call a thinking meditation, having a good idea of what that intention is, then continuously repeat that phrase of metta, like every few seconds, repeating that phrase, pointing the mind towards that intention, and then notice if you can discern a feeling which is connected to the thought of metta. Now, a lot of times I notice that some teachers will say that if you can't really develop a feeling of metta, you shouldn't worry about it. Just do the phrase anyway. You know, it's okay. That's true, it is okay. It still is a good thing to do the phrase and to set up the intention of metta. But as a practice leading to jhana or leading to concentration, you will need to be able to develop a feeling of metta. The feeling of metta is not actually something that can be forced. It's something that comes by itself. It comes from your subconscious. It comes into your body. It makes endorphins get generated and go into your blood and creates a pleasant feeling somewhere in the body. Some people experience these waves and waves and waves of big feelings. And for those people, we suggest that they may incline more towards calmness. And then some people, they can't actually, not even sure, they might feel something, but they're not sure what it is, and they're not exactly sure if it's pleasant or not. For those people, we suggest just be patient, just keep doing the practice repeatedly, and there will be a moment when there's just something clear, say, oh, yes, that's a happy feeling. And then when you get to that, then use mindful attention to make that feeling more bright by paying attention to it. So that's the second next step of this. You pay attention, make it more bright, make it stable by continuing to pay attention to it, and lift up the mind over and over again towards this thought of metta by using the phrase. So while you're doing all this, you're repeating that phrase of metta, you're lifting the mind, pointing the mind towards that intention, and then having this awareness for the feeling in the body. See if you can develop that, if you can make it be kind of stable, and if you can keep going for, I'll say, 20 minutes without getting lost and losing track of what you're doing. If you're not able to do this, it's because some kind of hindrance is preventing you. Perhaps for giving metta to yourself, you might think that you don't actually deserve to be happy. So you've got self-hatred. So if then this metta practice is difficult or impossible to do, then we've gained some really great information. We know that there's a hindrance present that needs to be worked on, that needs to be resolved, that needs to be solved. And these hindrances can be solved. That's like, it's the whole magic of Buddhism. You know, he doesn't say, you know, here we are down in the swamp with all of our problems, all of our woes, all of our personality problems, all of our emotional problems. And the Buddha sort of points up to Mount Everest and says, you know, this is Nibbana. Go there. That's not the way he does. What he does is he has got, in so many different ways, in so many different suttas, what's called a gradual training. It's a training that is, it's got this quality they call leading onward. So one thing leads to another thing. In so many different ways and different teachings, gives us ways that we can take qualities, our factors of mind, our factors that we already have in existence, and take that factor and purify the factor, make it elevated, make it more noble, and develop it. And that's how we get A, B, C, D. It's just like climbing up a ladder. So it's a very practical kind of thing. And just suppose you're trying to do metta for yourself and you just can't. Okay? And this particular technique that I'm suggesting, I will not let you off the hook, and I will not say, okay, if you can't give metta for yourself, give metta to your dog, or give metta to a dear person. In this method, the problem should be faced up to, and then we're in this experimental process of trying to learn how to give up hindrances. This is another experience that I had early in my meditation. I'm a good meditation teacher because I'm such an ordinary person. I'm very average. I don't have like a natural talent for meditation or spiritual things. Instead, I have all the same problems that everybody else has. Because I was able to work with some of my problems, then I can tell you that I can promise that it is possible to do. And I know some ways of how to do it. In this gradual training, going back to the text, the Buddha would talk about acquiring faith from hearing the Dhamma, purifying the sila, purifying the virtue, and then developing this loving kindness, the four Brahma Viharas, and developing the boundless mind and letting them spread throughout the universe. And then he would say the next stage of practice is to abandon the hindrances and go into meditation. And for many years, I would come to this sequence, which occurs in many different suttas, and sort of pull my hair out. I had hair then. Because I didn't know how to abandon hindrances. So you've got to find out how to abandon hindrances. I believe that that is work that has a lot of individuality, that following a standard technique or a standard recipe might or might not work for you. But if you discover for yourself a method or a technique or a thought process that's effective for you to let go of some kind of a formation that's troublesome, then you will have learned something very valuable indeed, and something that you can keep and that you won't lose. Just for example, person with this problem of self-hatred, I came up with in a discussion with one person, she had this idea of a dedication of merit. If she felt she's not doing this practice just for her own selfish reasons, but she's doing this practice so that she'll get some benefit from it, and then she's going to turn around and use that benefit to help other beings. She had to give herself a contemplation that says, I'm not doing this for selfish reasons, I'm doing this for generous reasons, I'm going to dedicate the merit to help such and such other people and such beings. Mm-hmm. And that enabled her to jump over that hurdle of feeling unworthy. So something like that might work, or it may be some different technique that would be effective for you. The hindrances need to be overcome. You need to learn how to give metta, say, for yourself. Learn how to do it consistently. Learn how to be able to notice feelings. Notice what intentions are, so you'll begin to get some kind of clarity about the different factors that make up our mental and emotional life. And then when you've mastered that, then you go on to the next person, the dear person. That dear person, what's going to be the problem there? Greed, right? Because mm-hmm. we want that dear person to like us anyway. Right? So we kind of want to get something from that dear person. So then it may be necessary to do some different kind of work to overcome a different group of problems that might arise when we attempt to give the thought of metta to a dear person who is an actual dear person. By the way, if you're going to try this at home, don't use the person that you're sleeping with, or the person you're having sex with, or the person that you would like to have sex with, because that makes it more complicated. After you've mastered the practice, you can give metta to those individuals. But in the beginning, just for the sake of simplicity, choose somebody where that's not a factor. When you come to the neutral person, what's the problem there? Problem is indifference. You don't care. That's why they're neutral. You could care less. One suggestion about the neutral person is don't choose somebody who's really boring. Choose somebody who's, you know, a normal person, not some, you know, wimp. Choose a normal person who's just not somebody that you happen to be that in a kind of a close relationship with. And then you will have anticipated this problem of boredom or lack of commitment or indifference in doing the practice, that that's what's going to make it hard to sustain loving kindness for that person for 20 minutes, which I've set as my rule. And then what you got to do is to stir up energy. And so now you have to learn how to bring the factor of energy into your meditation. You can do that even just by thinking about it. Or you can do it by paying attention to energy. Energy is called a virya, which is related to the word virile, so it's like manly energy. There's three kinds of energy. One is an energy, the effort that's associated with starting. So if you don't, you know, trying to get out of bed or trying to do something that you don't want to do, you got to be able to start, right? And then once you start, you have to be able to sustain. And then once you know how to sustain, then you need to know how to push or go beyond, how to do energy more than what you thought possible before. If your meditation is too passive anyway, and this is this lack of commitment or boredom in the practice is something that is real for you, one suggestion I make is just going in through your life, notice the presence of energy in the ordinary things that you do in life. You have to, you know, you're maybe involved with some sport, or you may be involved with work, you may be involved with driving a car. All of these things require focus, energy, paying attention, sustaining, starting. If anybody is a parent, they certainly must know what it's like to surpass, to have that kind of surpassing energy where it goes beyond what you thought you could possibly do. You end up giving more than you ever believed you had in you because of the requirement of being a parent. And so remember what that's like. And then when you're trying to bring energy into your meditation, do a preliminary contemplation, think about the kinds of energy that you have in your life, how they feel. Try to get a kind of embodied awareness of energy in your life. Stir up energy, and then do that practice. Then the difficult person, the way I hear the problem expressed with the difficult person is that the mind tends to get carried away with the story. So it's impossible to stay on the practice of metta because you're thinking, you know, may so-and-so be happy. That, well, if they just didn't have this irritating problem, then they would be happy. And so then we start thinking about the person, so the mind is not able to stay internally within your own body, within your own heart, within your own intention. You're not able to keep the mind with your own focus on your own intention for this person. Instead, the mind gets like glued onto that other person and their irritating qualities. The solution that I've been taught for that, first of all, it's a development of equanimity. But I was given a really interesting method. Equanimity is often connected with looking at the elements in the body. If you think this just only earth element, only water element, only fire element, then whatever like attachment you have or the mental formations you have kind of goes away, and it's much easier to develop an equanimous feeling. As I was taught this, we do this meditation on the skeleton, which is very earth element. Skeleton has got this solidity to it. So the skeleton is as solid as a mountain. It's like a tree. It just stands there. You do a kind of a review of visualizing the bones in the body, the skeleton in the body, and then bring up the thought of metta first for yourself and go through yourself, your dear person, and your neutral person, and you work very carefully at spreading that sense of metta to the body so that the whole body is just kind of like bursting with the feeling of metta. And you put metta into the skeletons. You put metta into your bones. this is an imaginative thing. You make your bones are like radioactive with metta. And then having developed this and having gotten a lot of momentum going, then you just bring the name of that difficult person, but don't think about them. Just put their name in without actually thinking about them. Just give metta to that name without paying attention to their qualities. I did have one student who couldn't catch the wave about that feeling of metta for a whole retreat. This was like a week-long retreat, and when we got to that difficult person, he caught it. Mm-hmm. And it was like, whoa. So then, if you master this, and you are able to continue doing this practice, the following stage is to just keep repeating. Just keep repeating this practice over and over again. And what happens is that the bodily part of it will fade out, and the mental part becomes more clear. And the stability will become very great because you will have overcome at least four different classes of problems that you had with four different persons. So the mind has attained a certain kind of a pliability and a flexibility, a strength and a skill to be able to use different methods to prevent different problems that can stop your meditation from working. You just keep doing this and keep doing this until something changes in the quality of your meditation. You know those, I guess at the circus, there's like the little car and there's like 20 clowns get out of a small car. Or you could go into a small car and it's like much bigger inside than it looked. So it's like you're going inside this limited frame of this body and mind, and something has shifted and it seems to be really, really, really big, really vast, really unlimited. The things that disturb, like the distracting sounds or the distracting aches and pains in the body and so forth, may seem to be kind of like far away, like in a different room. This would be we call technically neighborhood concentration. That's a place where you can practice. The mind has this, there's a feeling of boundless or big mind. That's the place to do metta for all beings. When you get there, that's the time to let the metta come out from you like the man blowing the conch and having the sound go in all of the directions without any impediment, without any limitation, boundless and not limited. Now you're ready to start meditation. After done, this is all preliminary work. Now you're ready to start meditation, and now you'd be ready to encounter the Four Noble Truths and the unique teachings of Buddhism. But it's a beautiful practice, and if you are interested in pursuing this, the person I learned this from is a monk called Bhante Sujato, and he learned it from a Thai monk called Lungpur Maha Chat Chai. Maha Chat Chai. If you Googled Sujato and the word Sujato and the word metta, you can get some guided instructions to follow this technique. And you might, if you send me a nice email, you might get me to send you the same thing in my version, which is a little different than his version. It's well worth doing. It's something that can be transformative in all kind of everyday practice. This kind of happiness that we can find in meditation is something that is not depending on a healthy body, it's not depending on good relationships, it's not actually depending on anything except our own practice. And when you have that, you've got a kind of a safety that you can be resilient to withstand a lot of different kinds of grief and stress and difficulty. And things, you know, all kind of bad things can happen in your life. But you may know there is this happiness and I know how to get there. So I can go there and have my pleasant abiding. And so I don't actually need to be afraid of the painful or difficult things that might happen in my life. Because my happiness is not depending on external things that happen to me. My happiness is depending on my own practice and my own faith in a spiritual path which is good and true, and my own willingness to just make the right efforts, confident that it's going to produce these kind of results.